The World Cup Championship will be crowned this week, and you can trade the tourney through the finals on Kalshi, America's number one prediction market platform. Right now, Spain is trading at 58% to beat Argentina, meaning 100 trade pays out 166 if they win. On Kalshi, you're trading against other people in a live market. No house, no odds makers. For a limited time, download the Kalshi app and use code DEFEND to get $10 when you trade $10. K-A-L-S-H-I. Kalshi. Trade the beautiful game. 18 plus only. Restrictions and eligibility requirements apply. Event contract trading involves risk and may not be suitable for all investors. Kalshi products are not available in all jurisdictions. Prices, values, and available markets may differ from those mentioned. For more information, see kalshi.com/regulatory.
The Round Golf Podcast with Richard Kaufman.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Round Golf Podcast again. Now, obviously, with the Masters around the corner, this, I think, is a great look at the circumstances that led to Danny Willett putting on the green jacket and the fall that came afterwards. Now, I'm sure most of you, at least, should be aware these interviews aren't all recorded in the last week. It's not live either. I'd love it to be, but travelling, commentating on TV and being at these events, that's when I get the chance, obviously, to sit down with these famous golfers, talk about the round that changed their career, how they got there, what happened afterwards. Now, this interview with Danny Willett was recorded just before he won in Dubai, but believe me, and I've listened back to it a few times, the interview does still stand as a great insight into Danny, the person, Danny the golfer as well. Not just the ride that was the Masters of 2016, but how he'd wished he had the shoulder of someone who'd been through a similar experience after winning as well. And you don't often hear Danny talk about religion, but of course we talk about family life. And in case you don't know, he is the son of a vicar. And there's the other family matter as well of the Ryder Cup. His brother's comments at pretty much changed the mood for him at Hazeltine. I think you're going to love it.
The round that you've chosen, Danny, I think most people either seen it, know about it, so they know what it's all about, but maybe not necessarily from your perspective, although I know you've done a number of interviews regarding that final round. Mm-hmm. The interesting thing to start with is, of course, you were the last man to arrive in the field at Augusta National that week, and of course you nearly didn't turn up that week.
Yeah, it was a strange old week. Obviously we registered 89 out of 89 guys, and we pitched up on late on Monday. Obviously I just had the birth of Zach a few days before, and Nick was recovering pretty well. So, you know, the decision was that if she was all right, you know, we were gonna come out and obviously go play. You never really want to miss any major, but especially not Augusta. So, yeah, fortunately the little guy came out on the 29th of March and gave us a few days there to get over to America, which was pleasant. So, yeah, I obviously chose Sunday. It's an incredibly memorable round. For many reasons, it was, you know, just thinking about it when you said about the, you know, which one is, and for me, it still probably would be within that tournament. But the, you know, any of those rounds have their own kind of specialities in there. The first round's always a tricky one if you feel like you've rushed to get to a golf tournament or whatever, and easing your way into the golf tournament and what draw you on, how you play, and you know, I think every round in there could have possibly been. We could have probably spoke about any of those four rounds.
Because it's only your second time at Augusta National. Yeah. So turning up late, it's not like this is a golf course you know so well.
No, I mean, we got lucky the first year when we got in. We got in on the nose, number 50 in the world. So we got our letter through the post early January. So we kind of knew, and me and Johnny knew early doors that we were going to obviously be playing. So we went there early. The very first year I played, and I spoke to the guys at the pro shop and hired one of the best caddies that they had that have worked for a long time there, and we went there before and got a lot of golfing. So I was prepared in the fact that Augusta's a strange place. You know, there's kind of six pin positions on every green, and they just vary it round. You've watched it on TV since you were a boy. You know roughly how things unfold at Augusta. We always do. They never try and shoot for a score. They kind of let the conditions prevail, and if it's a tough, cold winter, It'll be playing difficult. If they have beautiful weather in April, like they can get off in there. obviously the golf course can play a bit easier. So they never try and curtail the scoring anyway. So you've really just got to adapt and go with the flow of and kind of get how the golf course is playing and go from there. So yeah, we weren't prepared in the most amazing way, like I'd like to be. But in terms of being there as relaxed as I guess you could be and enjoying everything that was happening and kind of taking everything as they came, I was probably in a better place than I would have been if I'd have got there early and tried preparing.
And what a way to get through the sleepless nights, you know,
avoid exactly. I got out of them really early and changing nappies.
In all seriousness, you said it, I assume you meant it, if the due date, which was the Sunday round of the Masters, if that was the birth date, you wouldn't have gone to Augusta.
No, I mean, I can obviously say it now, you're going to play a lot of majors, and we're probably not going to have four kids a year, you know, but there are four majors a year, and golf is golf, and as heartbreaking as it would have been to miss Augusta that year, it would have probably been a hell of a lot more heartbreaking to miss the birth of your child. So, the decision was always that. I was always pretty firm on that. And, luckily the little man decided to listen to me and came out early.
Okay, so you mentioned all rounds are important. Mm. Round one, you shoot 70, which is four behind the leader, Jordan Spieth. Round two, 74, you're still four behind Jordan Spieth.
Tough Friday it was, I remember that. Really windy, very gusty.
Yeah, but you're still right there. And then round three of 73... And now you've made some ground up on Jordan Spieth. You're actually three behind Jordan going into the final round. So, I mean, this is real contention. This is real major possibility.
Yeah, and it's not sparkling golf. You know, like I just said, they'd ever try and curtail the scoring. The scoring in 2016 was pretty high. When Zach Johnson won, I think he won it. Was he level or one or two over or something? Because it was freezing cold that year. I remember watching it on TV. And no one could get up on all the par fives, and you know, and in 2016 it was blustery winds, and around that place it's just a nightmare. Obviously, when you get the winds gusting around Amen Corner, trying to pick clubs into them tight little back sections, it's just a tricky golf course when the wind is bouncing around the trees, and the golf course was playing relatively long, because it wasn't warm, but it wasn't, you know. So yeah, we were right in there. I think there are some crazy stats at Augusta about needing to be within certain positions, certain amounts of shots behind, with however many holes or rounds to play to have a chance. So
we're about five behind with nine to play.
Well, that one was probably slightly less likely. but they always say that the winner of Augusta comes from the last kind of five, six, seven groups on a Sunday, because it's not a place where someone goes out early, shoots a number, and waits for guys to come in. It's a very consistent scoring through the field, you know. We were in touching distance with 18 to play, three back. Not so much with nine to play. And then, kind of how the round unfolded. We eased our way in quite nicely. We were really patient. We'd had six straight pars. Two and a half years ago now? A lovely little cut 7-iron into the sixth of par three, and rolled in like a 12, 13 footer. Probably had about two cups out the left of breaking for birdie. And that kind of got things going. Two great golf shots up to the front edge of number eight to about 25, 30 feet, and two putter there for birdie. Pulled a tee shot into the trees on nine, trying to take it really tight to the trees on the left, and I've just clipped a couple of the high ones and it's kind of come down, and then tried to rope up a 6-iron around the corner, and that up and down was probably, there were two up and downs in that round that really changed, really changed how the momentum was swinging in that day. And the up and down on 9 had a little weird downhill lie on the right hand bank there, and I tried to use the middle tier ledge, and it didn't quite come down far enough. I had about 6-7 feet left, and it's one of them putts that you watch then you've seen it on Augusta. The greens are probably running 12 or 13 flat, but on that putt, they're probably running at 20. You know, you struggle to see how the ball's actually stopped there. When you stood over it, you're thinking, blimey, you know, all I've got to do is get this moving, you know, and then to try and do that with your hand shaking, try and start it online, just roll it end over end, not do anything stupid, and rolled in a great 6-7 footer there for par. Had a really good amen corner, some really solid pars around there. And then I was hitting fade that week, quite predominantly, and then tried to hit draw around the corner of 13, which came off quite nicely. Just ended up in the semi, just on the corner cut there. 5-iron in there to kind of 50-odd feet, and a great two-putt. And all of a sudden, you're kind of thinking, you know, I'm playing pretty good here. I was 300 at the time. I'd not done anything stupid. but I'd not gone, at no point in the round, you see, had I given anything back to anyone.
But Jordan's gone.
Jordan's also started pretty good, hadn't he? He started.
Well, he birdied the last four holes of the front nine.
Exactly, and I'm so kind of after five holes, we're still probably, I can't remember the scores as they go, but we're probably still three behind, with probably still a handful of guys in and around able to do anything.
Just have interest, because you're describing it. You can, I know you're animated as you're talking, and I know you can remember each. How many times have you watched it back?
No.
You haven't?
No, I've watched it back once when I got back. I watched it once when I got back a few days after.
And not since?
Not really. I've got it on, we've obviously got the CDs and the discs of it and a few of the bits that go with it, but.
I bet the family have watched it back a few times.
You know what, yeah, they probably have, but I don't, no one's ever, Mum and Dad watched it with me. I watched it 2 days after I got back.
What, with everybody?
No, just me and Nick. The little guy was obviously tiny, so we were just there, and we cracked open a bottle of wine. I remember watching it, because everything was still very blurry in terms of. I almost remember it more now than I did straight afterwards. I could almost tell you exactly what numbers we had, where we were, how the lie was, where the win was. You know, and I've played 350 golf tournaments, you know, around the world probably, just since turning pro, and I've hit countless amounts of thousands of shots. And yeah, you can still. When something's that deep in your imagination, deep in your memory, in your mind, yeah, you can still remember the smells and, like I said, where the wind was, things that you were aiming at, whether it'd be, you know, a lady in bright yellow or whatever it'd be. So yeah, it's still, from not watching it, it's pretty, yeah. Mm. I've still got a pretty good yard for yard recollection, I guess.
Because you didn't watch the moment that catapulted you from the fringes of contention to the lead.
Yeah, I've seen that a couple of times, but that's purely because obviously people have played it over and over again. Yeah, but when I watched it back, obviously I was watching myself down 15 at the time. Mm-hmm. I just pulled my tee shot, so I couldn't go for the green, which was really annoying, because it's a good eagle chance of that back flag. Obviously, out of all the pins on that green, that's the one where you wouldn't mind having a long iron into, because you've got a bit of room there. And yeah, I've just pulled my tee shot, I had to chip and run it through the trees and left myself a tricky little wedge shot on the downslope and missed a 12-foot for birdie. Then as Johnny's put the flag back in, everyone's kind of gone, ooh, and then we've looked round and looked again with a bit confused as to what had just happened. So yeah, obviously when I then watched it back on the Wednesday or the Thursday after I got back home, you see how it all unfolded. Yeah, it was just a crazy 10, 15 minute spell for both of us, emotionally for both of us. You can't imagine what's going through Jordan's mind in the position. I mean, he's been in that position so many times in for such a young lad. He's been in that position a lot of times. You'd never really expect it. And even when I watched it, I knew the result of what had happened, but you still couldn't believe that it had happened.
And you're playing with Lee Westwood, who...
Westy just chipped in for eagle on the back of 15. Great chipping.
Have a sip of coffee, go. Yeah, so he chips in at 15. So now you're going to the 16th tee.
16th tee, leading by one over Westy at... What would it have been? 5 under par. Westy got to 4. Jordan had obviously dropped back to, I can't remember, 2-3 or something, was it? And I nipped off for a quick pee. There's a little cabin behind the 16th tee, luckily, through the crowd. So there's 10,000 people around the 16th hole. And luckily, I get to go in my little log cabin, have a pee. And
can I ask, is that on purpose?
No.
I needed to go.
I needed to go to the bathroom. And in hindsight, it was quite a nice little thing. You kind of take yourself away from the situation. Serenely quiet. In that, you know, the sheriff obviously opens the door and he stands guard and stuff. And serenely quiet and just... You know, that's the first time I'd actually properly had a word with myself about, you know, we said we were going to go out and try and play aggressive all day and see what happened. You're in a situation here that you practice for countless years of your life. This is the when it's going dark and your mum and your dad are tooting the horn for you to get in the car and go home because it's 6 week holidays and you're still hitting putts or hitting chips. You know, and this is that time when you're like, right, this is to win the Masters, this is to win the Open, this is to win the, you know what I mean? You always hold putts on the greens to win a major when you're a kid. And it was that scenario where I said, well, let's just try and make some real good swings down the last few and see what happens. Obviously, we're now leading over Westy. I'm like, luckily, I'm pretty close to Westy and Billy, so I class it as a four ball, me, Johnny, Billy and Lee. You know, it was a great position to be in with people who you know. Being in that situation, for example, if you were up against a Tiger or, you know, back in the day, and just, I feel like that would have been a much tougher situation to be in, but being with, knowing Lee so well and knowing Billy so well and obviously having Johnny on the bag was quite a calming experience, I would say, if it can be classed as that.
But I heard you were shaking on the 16th.
Oh, me and Johnny have gone through the numbers and I've got my book, and me and him laughed about it actually afterwards, because he's obviously nervous as well. He's wanting to get everything right, I want to do everything right, and he remembers seeing the paper shaking on the book, and I remember him thinking, he said to me afterwards, thinking to himself, I'm bloody glad someone else is nervous as well, it's not just me.
But how do you control that shaking?
You can't. I spoke to a few people about shaking and being nervous and this and that. You can't just switch it off and go, right, body, stop shaking. You can't. You've just got to realise that they're there for a reason. They're there because you're anxious. You're anxious because you're in a situation that's uncommon, unknown. It's a great situation to be in. You're scared, you're nervous. There's so many different emotions flowing through your body of the unknown, really. You don't know what's going to happen within golf. Any situation, you don't know what's going to happen. So, and I think that's where most people come undone, isn't it? Is because that situation then overwhelms them with emotion, and you're like, how am I supposed to hit a golf shot here? Where actually, if you can use it, if you get in that situation, you can use it and say, you know what, I'm nervous for a reason, but I know that everyone else is going to be nervous if they're in the same situation. So
you had a great up and down at 9, and it's an amazing chip and putt at 17 as well.
Yeah.
But given the fact that you've just walked off the 15th green, you've seen Jordan Spieth numbers tumble by 4 shots, you're now leading. That tee shot at 16, was that maybe the shot?
Yeah, it was. A full shot's probably easier to hit under pressure than a chip. The touch and the feel involved in it, in a delicate chip off a tight lie, trying to pitch it on your number, get the right strike with the right flight, up and over a bank, or even holding a 3-footer, I would say is a lot harder than hitting a full shot to some degree. I appreciate the full shots look better, don't they, on TV. They look, you know, we hit a rope up 8-iron in from 179 there, I think it was, because we knew we couldn't fly it on top. We were only trying to hit it kind of 20, 25 foot short, really, putting that on that bottom ledge, not far from, just past where Westy's was, really. And that, but obviously with adrenaline, I've absolutely ripped it and it's come out perfect. But then again, like the putt was probably harder to hold the putt than to hit the 8-iron in that close under the situation.
But I'm only saying it from the outside looking in. You talked about the shaking.
Yeah.
You talked about I'm leading the Masters.
Yeah, it is. But again, then on the 16th green, a lot happened, didn't it? Westy obviously 3 putts. I roll mine in. All of a sudden, you go from 1 shot to 3 shots with 2 to play. I mean, it's, you know, like I said, in the space of that 30-40 minute section there, it's gone from being a 1-horse race to a 3-horse race to almost a 1-horse race again, as to where you're then in a situation that's really naughty to being in it, where you can only throw it away then. You've got a 3-shot lead with 2 to play. It's then, you're not I was chasing all day, got to a stage where it was maybe too far away unless something silly happened. Something silly did happen. But then it actually went the extreme, you know. If you actually look at from on the 9th, on the 10th tee where Jordan was to where we were on the 17th tee, I haven't ever even counted it up, but it's almost like an 8-9 shot swing. All of a sudden you're behind by 5 to being in front by 3, stood on 17. It's like I said, what happened in that short space of time was incredibly surreal in the ins and outs and how golf could go. Not a bad tee shot, 17, pulled it a little bit. I can't remember, just on the fairway, I think, and I've tried to hit a big eye draw over the corner of the trees and just pulled it a bit. Again, a bit of adrenaline, just pulled it a bit, landed on the little knuckle and then, yeah, rolled to the back there. And that chip there was pretty naughty. I quite fancy myself short game-wise, but that was still, looking back at it, that was still a very naughty little chip.
And I don't want to rush through the next, because I'm loving hearing what you're saying about this round, but I've got so many things I want to ask you. But I know you're watching, you know, you putt at 18. When you finish, I know you can't celebrate.
Yeah, I know.
But you thinking, this is mighty close.
Though. Yeah, I mean, what do we have? 14 feet? And again, you're just trying not to do anything stupid. You know, I rolled up there to a foot, tapped it in. Yeah, you can't celebrate because Jordan still had, what do you have, 5 holes left? About 5 holes left, 4 holes left. As I was finishing, he hit a lovely shot into, I didn't see 15 because I think I was marking my card and doing some bits. And I watched him play the last three. He hit a lovely shot into 16, about 8 foot, just behind the flag. And I remember watching that thinking, if this goes in, it's obviously, he's back within a couple.
But how surreal was that? Suddenly now, you're in a room, there's a camera on you.
And
you're watching TV, watching golf.
I was trying to FaceTime Nick. I mean, I had a million and one emails, text messages and everything. And I'm trying to then, obviously, you're thinking, yeah, I'll reply to these in a bit. I'm trying to speak to Nick, how she is. And then you're also at the same time watching on TV, thinking this is mental, really, in the scenarios. And then he stands on 17, it's a nice drive down the middle. And then I'm thinking, right, makes birdie here, he can birdie the last. Because I was thinking if he finishes three in a row, he wins by one. I think that's right. I can't remember that everyone else's exact numbers. So then I'm thinking, right, well, if he birdies 17 and it's straight down it, but he turns away, so I'm thinking, oh, that might be short. Goes to the bunker, I'm thinking, right, he holds a bunker shot, he can still birdie the last. Don't hold a bunker shot, I'm thinking, right, we can still make two up 18 if he does this. And basically when he made five up 17, that was when Johnny came running in. I was on the sofa.
Jumped on you.
Johnny came running in and jumped on us. So, just how things can change in such a short space of time.
Back with the interview with Danny Willett in a minute. But if all the talk about the Masters has got you revved up for the first major of the year, then you'll be interested in this superb golf game, the Fitzdares Fantasy Masters. Now, I know I say it every time, but apologies if you're listening from outside of the UK, because you've got to be a UK resident to play. You've got to be 18 years old as well. Very simple. All you've got to do, pick a five-man team plus a reserve for the upcoming Masters at Augusta. The winnings of your five players at the end of the Masters and then add it up, that makes your final score. There are three different entry fees for this game. You can play for either a tenner for £100 or £1,000. Now, last year, the £100 game had a prize pot of £140,000. Now, the winner gets to pocket 40% of the prize pot. You have to be in the top 25, though, to get any winnings. The website will show you the prize breakdown. You can enter more than one team. In fact, you enter four, you get a fifth free. You can also share the competition with a friend, and if they win, you'll win a percentage too. Now, you can follow your team's progress on a real-time leaderboard. My team, for what it's worth, is Rory McIlroy, Kirit Ekpemirat, Tiger Woods, Justin Rose and Mark Leishman. My reserve, had to get him in there, is Danny Willett. To get playing, you got to go to fantasy.fitzdares.com. That's fantasy.fitzdares.com, where you'll also find the terms and conditions. As with all forms of gambling, make sure you play responsibly and be gamble aware. Now back to more chat with Danny Willett.
You're listening to the Round Golf Podcast with Richard Kaufman.
An incredible round, an incredible tournament for you to win. And I don't know where to go next. Do I go, I've heard you say no one prepares you for what comes next, or do I go back to how it all came along? I kind of feel like I should go to what you said about no one prepares you for what happened next.
Yeah. You practice, don't you? We're golfers, we practice for golf. We don't practice for anything else, really, that comes along with stuff. And you don't realise quite how big of a deal it was until you get home and there is a massive hype on what you've just achieved. You know, we got to top 10 in the world. We were leading the order of merit. We're doing this, we're doing that. You first person since Sir Nick Faldo, first Englishman, sorry, since Sir Nick Faldo to win at Augusta. You know, you're then within a handful of Europeans to have won majors and stuff like that. It's you know, there was a very elusive club to be in, I guess.
Because it wasn't like it hadn't been coming, as you mentioned. You know, second on the race in Dubai, top 15 in the world.
Yeah, we'd been playing nice.
One in Dubai, you know, fifth win.
We'd been playing nice and stuff. It's just, again, it's the height and level of what the majors do to your career and to the sport. But again, it was just a strange time. I'd I was always going to take 4 weeks off if I got in it. If I was able to play Augusta because of Zach, I was going to take 4 weeks off afterwards and spend time at home. Then 4 weeks went in what seemed like a couple of minutes because of everything that got thrown into the whirlwind. And then we kind of got pulled from pillar to post maybe a bit too much and travelled a bit too much and played a bit too much, trying to make everything work and didn't quite spend enough time at home just relaxing and taking it in. And then maybe didn't get back to work in the correct way, you know. So yeah, things just kind of imploded a little bit, and there was just a lot going on, a lot of outside noise going on and other stuff, and yeah, struggled to quite kind of partition it off into the proper sections, I guess.
Was there no one who'd been through this experience that you could talk to about it?
There's a few guys, but it's, at the time, you know, you didn't really know them amazingly well. I knew the guys, you could ask Rory, but Rory had been in that situation since he'd been 10. You know, Rory knew a lot of the things, but...
But you've been world number one as an amateur.
Yeah, I know, but it's, you know, and as amazing as a compliment as that was, it's still worlds apart from where that was. At the time, obviously Sergio, I was close with, you know, a lot of the European lads, Sergio, Henrik, Rory, Lee, all them guys, but actually, at the time...
Only Rory.
Only Rory had been there. Obviously now, looking back... Yeah, could have really asked him, and I've spoke to them guys since about obviously certain other aspects in their careers and stuff. But yeah, at the time it was a strange old place. You know, me being at home and stuff, Nick and her family had never experienced it. My mum and dad certainly had never experienced any of the stuff that had happened around it. And yeah, it was just like I said, it was maybe just a little bit overwhelming at the time. And yeah, it would be nice. I'd love to be able to wind it back and see where I am now and what's happened now. And I would love to be able to go back and kind of give it a bit of a rejig on how I would go about things.
Okay, I'm going to go back. You mentioned your mum and dad there and your family. Your dad, a vicar. Your mum, a teacher.
Mm.
Is that right?
She, yeah, she's mum's a maths teacher. Swedish, but yeah, she's Swedish. Yeah. Came over and met my dad. Married my dad really young. Yeah, she's been over in England now for 40 years. So yeah, dad's a vicar, mum's a maths teacher. Very normal working class parents.
And you took up the game sort of normal kind of age?
Yeah, probably a bit older, really. Yeah, 11, 12. I had two older brothers, so we played every sport under the sun just to get us out of the house and kicking the football, playing cricket, playing rugby, golf, you know. And
I heard you learned playing in a sheep field, is that
nah,
right?
Yeah, there's a part little... We used to go to Wales every summer for the six-week holidays. And the par three course and the driving range was basically... Yeah, it was all farmer's land.
Okay.
And yeah, so that's, you know, kind of where I, you know, the longest par three was about 100 yards, 110 yards, and it was the one sport that I could beat everyone at. You know, you can beat your dad, you can beat your brothers, and that's, for me, that was, at the time, being competitive, that's quite cool, isn't it, as a young kid, to be able to beat your brothers at something, because at football and everything else, they'd bash you around because you were the smallest, and this was a game where size don't matter, age don't matter, you know, you can go out there and play all of you together off your handicaps and have a good day. And I think that's the beauty of the sport in general, I would say. But for me, that's what kind of got me really hooked. And then you don't quite know how good you are until you get in like the regional squads and the national squads. And then, you know, you're comparing yourself then to the best kids in your county and then in the country. And then if you're lucky enough to play for your country, you can compare yourself to, yeah, within Europe. And then, yeah, like you say, you work up the world rankings and within the world. And then you kind of get a gauge of how good you are or where you could potentially go to.
Obviously, with your dad being a vicar, you're in a religious family. Never hear you really talk about religion.
Yeah, I mean, he never forced it on us. We're all Church of England Christians, but never forced anything upon us. My brother and me used to play football, Sunday League football. So he didn't stop us playing Sunday League football and going to church, you know. So it's no, but I think what it does teach you is, I think being a father now, it definitely helped with guidance of how you go about things in your own life, especially now having kids. And I can now see why my mum and dad didn't get too involved with me golfing. Just kind of wherever I needed to go, they took me. Always make sure I had golf balls in my golf bag.
I hear they weren't always that good though. You went to the golf course instead of school.
Yeah, my dad's day off was a Wednesday.
I'm saying that tongue in cheek.
My dad's day off was a Wednesday. So yeah, I don't think years 10 and 11 at comprehensive school, I had a lot of Wednesdays off.
But you eventually, the school realised there was a good reason for that.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, you know, I was pretty good at school anyway. I was never behind. I was always very, very good in school. I always did I was made up the work that I missed and stuff, but it was a day as to where, you know, I could, the golf course was a bit quieter, I can go, you know, play and practice and do it. Yeah, in hindsight, it was probably one of the best things that I did, but at the time, yeah, my mum wasn't very happy, obviously being a teacher, but I think she let me off now.
Yeah, I think it was worth missing those lessons for. So, I mean, I mentioned already you were number one amateur in the world. You went to university in America for a little while. Was that an important journey?
It was something I'd already wanted to do. I've always been a pretty independent kid, and I knew that the college golf system was a very good place to grow as a person and as a golfer. So, yeah, I signed a full scholarship to go to JSU, and then we kind of, from there, we had 2 years there. I was supposed to do four, did two, but was pretty good in terms of the academics, having to teach yourself to get up at the moment. We had 6 o'clock workouts, you had class from 9 to 12, you then got to get yourself to the golf course, you practice for 4 or 5 hours, you go play 9 holes to try and qualify for the week after, you had to make sure you did all your homework stuff. It was just, in terms of growing up as a person, being on your own, you've got to be pretty organised there with your time and how you do things. And I think above anything else, that's kind of what it gives you. You know, it's pretty easy, isn't it, to kind of take 2 years off school and stay at home, and your mum and dad are cooking, cleaning, driving you to golf course, giving you pocket money, doing this, doing that. You sink into it being really easy. Whereas at college, a lot of kids drop out because of juggling all the aspects you've got to juggle. Being on tour now for a few years, you've got a hell of a lot more aspects when you get out on tour to juggle around. Fortunately, obviously, we've got people to help and stuff if you're in a position as to where you can employ people to take some of that strain away from you. But you've still got to be, at the end of the day, you are still the boss, as you like to take it, of your team. And you've still then got to organise that within itself. No, college for me was a big stepping stone in growing up, really. I went there when I was 17. I went pretty young, again, because my academics were good. I was able to go there a little early. And like I said, I only did the 2 years, but at the end of the second year, I'd played in a couple of tour events and done okay. I'd finished 19th in Seville and 10th in the Spanish Open, and I was world number one amateur, and I'd won a couple handfuls of amateur tournaments around the world, and it was kind of like, you know, there wasn't anything else then to gain from going back to college, apart from if you wanted a degree. And, you know, at the time, I was, like we all are, I didn't really fancy it because I didn't think I'd ever need it. So, you know, yeah, we came home, and then, I'd 6-8 months at home getting ready for tour school.
We'll jump forward, and you said that, you know, in hindsight, you wish you could have done certain things differently. I want to talk about the 2016 Ryder Cup, because here was something you must have dreamt of playing in, like holding that putt to win the Masters or a major. You must have dreamt of being in the Ryder Cup, and the word you used to describe it at the end of the Ryder Cup, I don't know whether I should say it or not, but it wasn't complimentary.
No, it was, you know, it's one of them things that you do want to be in that team every 2 years. You do want to represent and put on them European colours, and I did. And unfortunately, at the time when we got there, the game had started to just take a little bit of a downward spiral. I was pretty tired. Again, like I said, I'd probably done a bit too much through that summer. And I was mentally very tired, and it's a mentally incredibly draining week, as I now know. You didn't know that at the time. And went there. Golf game wasn't in amazing shape, so I wanted to do a lot of practicing, do a lot of preparation. You've got a lot of commitments within itself in that week, so your time's not always your own, and I found that a little tricky. And then obviously everything kind of got blown out of proportion a little bit, and just ended up being a bit of a disappointing week in a couple of ways, for something that theoretically is one of the greater highlights of most people's golfing career.
Your brother came out with these comments. I don't need to go through them all. It's been said already many, many times over. But I heard your family, they wanted to go, they didn't even want to stay for the Ryder Cup, is that right?
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't a great time, really, on how everything was dealt with and how people took it. You know, obviously media pick up on the areas they want to pick up on most, which is media.
But suddenly you're getting, you know, from, you know, 1 minute you're the Masters champion, next minute you're getting abuse out on the golf course.
It was a tough situation in the fact that I felt like the patrons that were at Augusta, and every time I've been to America, the fans have been amazing. in helping me along, trying to play good golf, cheering you on. And yeah, unfortunately that week it is very much obviously black and white with America versus Europe. So if there is anything at all for anyone to jump on, they will jump on it and try and take it to kind of give some a bit more fire to, you know, a golf tournament that probably don't need a great deal more anyway with how it's going. So yeah, it was just, you know, obviously if I'd have gone there playing great, and the body being great and the mind being great and the golf game being great and played really well, even if we would have lost, but the experience of me playing well under the circumstances would have still probably meant that it was a relatively memorable one. It was more, the reason I said them words is more for the fact that I know I played poorly, and that was, out of anything else, that was the most disappointing thing, is that I went there as reigning Masters champion and as number one on the race to Dubai. I'd qualified number one through the European rankings. And I went there and I performed badly. And that was, for me, that was the most disappointing thing out of the entire thing. Regardless of what had been said or what had happened, the most destroying thing for me is the fact that, I went there and my game wasn't very good that week and I wasn't able to get any points for us.
A couple more things then. Later that year, as you said, you're number one on the race to Dubai. I've heard you say you actually didn't want to carry on playing.
Yeah, I could have very happily took the last four events off. But then again, you're in a position where you've got a chance to win the Order of Merit.
But not wanting to play golf. I mean, had you ever felt like that before?
No, it was just like I was very tired. I was really tired mentally, physically. Like I said, I was working my nuts off trying to get the game back to where I knew it could be, and the game wasn't listening to me at all. Body wasn't listening. Body was in bad shape. It was pretty beaten up at times, and the back wasn't behaving and doing anything. And it was just always seemed like an uphill struggle to kind of get any form going and any momentum going. Every time I seemed to get a little bit, something else would get thrown in. I felt like I'd make a few good moves and a few good moves with a swing forward, and then the back would give way and wouldn't allow me to practice and stuff. And yeah, it would have been very easy to just pack up sticks and go. But obviously with the final series as they are and being where I were in the position on the Order of Merit, you kind of have to just kind of go play and see what happens. Unfortunately, it didn't quite work out.
And now, looking back at all of this and looking ahead, do you feel that, in a way, there's been some benefit from having these low points so you can hopefully in the future maybe appreciate things even more?
Yeah, exactly. And I think they will. If we're getting that situation again within winning a major and being up there in the race to Dubai, you'll listen to yourself and your body more about your scheduling and where you're going to play, what you're going to do.
Do you believe that will happen?
Yeah, it will happen. It just depends on when, doesn't it? Depends how long you got to wait. No one's got a crystal ball and tell you. So yeah, the prospects now are, you know, we're in a good place with the body, the mind's in a good place, the swing's getting in a nice place, working with foals, and you know, everything's back in the right direction. You know, and at the end of it all, 2 and a bit years gone by, got 2 beautiful boys, everyone's healthy, family life's really good. You know, so in terms of what only happened on the golf course, but within life, you know, yeah, there was a lot that happened within golf and my body and not playing well and this happening and whatever it was. But at the same time, you know, we were raising 2 kids, which is hard work in itself.
and going through what you went, you must have had a very supporting wife, Nicole's part, didn't
you? Yeah.
Because you must have been unpleasant to be with
sometimes. I imagine I was very unpleasant to be around. I imagine an interview with her would be quite interesting to see what she has to say. Yeah, no, she's a diamond. You know, even to the stage where if you wanted to practice 14 hours a day and slug yourself into a corner because you're unhappy about this, she'd be there when you needed to be there. And if you knew that she kind of needed to be out of the way for no backfire, then, you know, she was. She can read me pretty well. So, yeah, I've got a lot of supportive people around me at home, which has really helped. So there's a lot of people that have helped kind of pull through. And, yeah, it's been a tough old time, but things are now nicely in a place where I feel like we can really kick on. The body's starting to listen, you know, now we can train up more, you can practice more, and you can then really start to make good gains over the winter period and hopefully then come out in 2019 and get back to winning ways.
So obviously, as you can hear from the ending there, that was recorded, in case you don't remember me saying it, about half an hour or so ago. That was recorded before Danny won in Dubai. Now, I've spoken to Danny, and of course, winning that final event of the season on the race to Dubai last November was important. but he assures me it wouldn't have changed the round that he's chosen. And you can't blame him, can you? Dubai will hopefully be a significant moment in getting his career back on track, but winning the Masters, your first major, how do you beat that? I thought it was a great listen. I hope you agree too. And if you do, let us know. You can do so at The Round Podcast on Twitter, at The Round Golf Podcast on Facebook. Even more so, you can give us a rating. 5 stars would be great. Tell someone about the podcast as well. Lots in the archives for you to dip into as well if you haven't done that already. Thanks again to our sponsors, Red Ray and Navigate Contracting. And once again, thanks to all of you for listening.
Thank you for listening to The Round Golf Podcast with Richard Coughlan.
The World Cup Championship will be crowned this week, and you can trade the tourney through the finals on Kalshi, America's number one prediction market platform. Right now, Spain is trading at 58% to beat Argentina, meaning 100 trade pays out 166 if they win. On Kalshi, you're trading against other people in a live market. No house, no odds makers. For a limited time, download the Kalshi app and use code DEFEND to get $10 when you trade $10. K-A-L-S-H-I. Kalshi. Trade the beautiful game. 18 plus only. Restrictions and eligibility requirements apply. Event contract trading involves risk and may not be suitable for all investors. Kalshi products are not available in all jurisdictions. Prices, values, and available markets may differ from those mentioned. For more information, see kalshi.com/regulatory.
Drew McIntyre here from WWE. Wielding the Claymore can be a life of chaos. When I'm not dominating in the ring, Chumba Casino is how this warrior takes a wee break. With hundreds of online social games and new weekly releases, there's always something fresh to try. And those daily boosts, next level. Even my free time feels like Valhalla. So when life feels like a battle, kick up your feet, have some fun, and let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T's and C's. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.